senior official says Iran will not stop any of its current nuclear activities before the lifting of all sanctions. This comes after a report on the U.S. plan to offer some sanctions relief. Iran says unilateral sanctions against Syria only prolong the humanitarian crisis and the people suffering in the war-torn country. Also in the headlines, the head of Yemen's delegation in Oman talks says there is no serious attempt to reach a peaceful and fair solution to the country's conflict. It's good to have you with us. A top story, a senior Iranian official says Tehran will stop its 20% uranium enrichment only if the U.S. lifts all its sanctions on Iran first. The official said Tehran will further reduce its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. does not lift all sanctions, warning that Washington is rapidly running out of time. The remarks came in response to a report published in U.S. media that said Washington is to offer a new proposal to Tehran to jumpstart the talks on the nuclear deal as soon as this week. The report by Politico noted that the proposal asks Iran to halt some of its nuclear activities, such as work on advanced centrifuges and the enrichment of uranium to 20% purity. The United States, in return, would ease some of its economic sanctions imposed on Iran. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas says Iran can't trust the U.S. anymore after Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has seen the true colors of the Zionist imperial control of American policy, and they don't trust them, quite frankly. Not that they trusted them a great deal before, but it's now absolutely evident that it's America who has to really bend to the very logical demands of the Islamic Republic of Iran to show any kind of good faith or goodwill from Iran any further. And I think that it's significant that this week the Chinese have again reiterated their agreement with Iran in terms of $400 billion plus infrastructure support and the growing strategic ties, which also will have made the Americans very nervous. It's interesting that the timing of this offer from the Americans has come just after Iran has entered to that.
And Iran says unilateral sanctions against Syria only prolong the humanitarian crisis and the people suffering in the war-torn country. Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, said 10 years of conflict has negatively impacted Syria's economic situation. Addressing a UN Security Council session on Syria, Takht-Ravanchi added that the destructive effects of unilateral sanctions are further worsening the situation. The Iranian diplomat reiterated that no state should use economic, political, or any other type of measures, including unilateral sanctions, to coerce another state into doing something. Takht-Ravanchi also stressed the need for preserving Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity by eliminating terrorists and the withdrawal of foreign forces. Political commentator Faraz Ali believes the ultimate aim of the U.S. sanctions is to starve the people of Syria.
I think the ambassador has a good point here, because Iran is also suffering from sanctions, and if someone, Iran knows what sanctions does to a country. And actually, sanctions are a kind of economic warfare that could lead to a genocide. With regard to Syria, we have having a war there for 10 years, and what the other side, what the United States and other countries in the West didn't achieve by the war, they're trying to achieve it through sanctions. Because the aim with sanctions, in the end of the day, is to bring the Syrian nation to the point of starvation. And maybe they think that this kind of situation for the Syrian people will create a ground for a second uproar. That's not something new. The United States of America use the same rhetoric with regards to Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and so on. They have, with the war and sanctions now, they have turned Syria from a wheat exporter to a wheat importer. I mean, even U.S. allies in the region, like UAE, says that the sanctions is a challenge for rapprochement in Syria.
Yemen's chief negotiator says a fair solution to address the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country is yet to be proposed during the talks in the Omani capital. Mohammed Abdel Salam said there has been no serious attempt to reach a peaceful and fair solution resolution to the Yemeni crisis. He noted that the humanitarian situation in the Arab country will never be subject to any negotiation. The Yemeni delegation has said the humanitarian issues must not be tied to the complex political and military matters. The statements come as negotiations for ending the years-long Saudi-led war in Yemen are underway in Muscat. The talks are attended by envoys from the United Nations, the United States, Sweden, and the European Union. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist joining us. What do you make of the fate of the talks in Oman? Many would say it's a shame that there has been no solution yet to the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
It's beyond tragic that there has been no solution. Part of the problem is that the United States is involved. The United States should have no involvement in this because it's the United States that has financed this war by providing Saudi Arabia with deadly weaponry to use against the Yemeni people. It's the United States that has supported Saudi Arabia from the start and continues to, although U.S. President Joe Biden has said that he is going to at least reduce that level of support. But the fact that humanitarian issues are being tied to military and political issues is criminal. That should be completely separate. The people need to be assisted. They need food, shelter. They need medical attention. There's so much that they need that has nothing to do with the military and political situation. They should be completely separate. But you can rely on the United States to tie them together and to tell the Yemeni people that if they want peace, and if they want this kind of support, humanitarian support, then they're going to have to bend to the U.S. will in one way or another. So that's why I say the United States should have no involvement whatever in these negotiations.
Right. And Robert, the Saudi Arabia did offer a ceasefire proposal recently without lifting the blockade, the deadly blockade on Yemen. And the Yemenis said that there was nothing new in this ceasefire proposal. In your opinion, did Saudi Arabia try to portray the Yemeni forces as the aggressors during that proposal?
Not only as the aggressors, but as the unreasonable party. The Saudi Arabia is offering something, say, oh, we'll have a ceasefire, and they're proclaiming that. But the fact is, the blockade remains, so the ceasefire is almost meaningless because the people are still going to suffer because of the blockade. And what the Yemeni people want is relief from that suffering. So Saudi Arabia will present itself as the reasonable one, offering a ceasefire that Yemen rejects. But there is so much more to the story than what Saudi Arabia wants to portray to the public.
Right, indeed. And Robert, do you think Saudi Arabia, we're entering the seventh year of this war on Yemen. It's been very costly for Saudi Arabia. It hasn't achieved any of its goals. Many observers have said that Riyadh finds itself in a quagmire, you know, Vietnam-style quagmire. Mm-hmm. Would you go along with that?
I think so, yes. The Saudi Arabia has accomplished no goals. One would have thought that a country as powerful as Saudi Arabia would be able to overwhelm Yemen very quickly, but the Yemeni people have opposed this from day one. They want to establish their own form of government. They don't want to be forced to live under some puppet regime installed by Saudi Arabia and supported by the United States. So they have fought. And what Saudi Arabia has not considered, some of the U.S. never considers, is the will of the people to oppose this foreign intervention and this forcing of a system of government on them that they don't want. So Saudi Arabia has accomplished nothing in all these years except a trail of carnage and death and suffering that is unparalleled in recent times.
Robert, thank you very much indeed, as always, for your time. Robert Fantina, the author and journalist, joining us out of Kitchener, Ontario. And moving to other news, staying in the region, Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian man in the city of Haifa in the occupied territories. Regime forces initially arrested the man, then killed him, claiming he had a knife and tried to attack them. The victim's sister has, however, stated that her brother was not carrying any weapons of any sort. Following the killing, a rally was held in Haifa against the regime's atrocities. Israeli forces have in many similar incidents killed or jailed Palestinian civilians. The giant container ship, which had been stuck across Egypt's Suez Canal for nearly a week, is now on the move. Authorities say Ever Given made its way towards the Egyptian town of Ismailia, and that vessels were now traveling south towards the Red Sea. The Suez Canal Authority chairmen have said 113 ships crossed the channel from both sides by 8 p.m. GMT. The Evergreen had become jammed diagonally across a southern section of the canal in high winds early last Tuesday, halting traffic on the shortest shipping routes between Europe and Asia. The incident created disruptions in the global shipping industry, as around 30% of the world's shipping container volume moves through the canal daily. The Brazilian president has been forced to replace several ministers in the biggest cabinet reshuffle since he took power in January 2019. Jair Bolsonaro replaced six cabinet members, including the foreign and defense ministers, who both resigned on Monday. The shakeup comes as the far-right leader faces mounting pressure due to a deadly surge of COVID-19 in the country. In Brazil, the average weekly death toll has nearly quadrupled since the start of the year. The South American nation also remains the world's second worst hit country in terms of COVID-19 deaths and infections after the US. Brazil's official death toll now stands at nearly 314,000, and the total number of cases is above 12.5 million. A prosecuting attorney at the murder trial of African-American George Floyd says the police officer responsible for his death betrayed his badge.
Mr. Derek Chauvin betrayed this badge when he used excessive and unreasonable force upon the body of Mr. George Floyd.
Radio, television, social media, or any other media.
The remarks came on the first day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, who the white police officer charged with killing Floyd. Blackwell said Chauvin did not follow police procedures and acted callously. Prior to the opening of the court session, the Floyd family's lawyer described the trial as a referendum on the U.S. justice system.
Today starts a landmark trial that will be a referendum on how far America has come in its quest for equality and justice for all.
Trump warned that the defense in the trial will try to impugn the victim's reputation to defend Chauvin. The officer knelt on Floyd's neck during an arrest on May 25, 2020 for more than 8 minutes before he lost consciousness and died. The incident, which was filmed by bystanders, rocked the United States and led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of the African American community. Black rights activist Omali Yeshitele says the calling the trial a referendum on the U.S. justice system is obscuring the facts on George Floyd's murder and its aftermath.
After George Floyd was murdered, on May 25th, from May 25th through August, there was something like 10,000 or more rebellions, uprising, protests that happened in this country because African people do recognize, and the referendum has already occurred as far as we're concerned about the American justice system where African people are involved. And so there's no way that there's anything that can be said that will bring justice to the case of Floyd or any other Africans who live under this U.S. vicious, vicious, vicious U.S. colonial domination. It is not something where we've seen the maximum charge being offered. I mean, there's no first-degree murder charge here, which means intentional. And it is clear that you cannot rest your knee and your entire body weight on somebody's neck without intending to kill them. There's no way that can be seen otherwise. And it is a clear-cut case. And the problem that we are confronted with as Africans in this country all the time is no matter, we have a whole history of murder and brutality, but in every instance, we treat every incident like this incident as something where the Africans, the victims of the murder, has to prove that we are not guilty of something. Even the suggestion that this murder had something to do with a counterfeit $20 bill. And I'm reminded of Mike Brown. He's killed. And then there's a suggestion that earlier on he had stolen some cigars. And this is thrown into the mix without any evidence of this having anything to do with why he was killed. And it had nothing to do with why he was killed.
Asian Americans are the latest minorities in the U.S. to be a target of hate crimes. The recent surge in the number of attacks against people of Asian descent has provoked an outcry in the country. What are the reasons behind the violence against the community, and how can it be addressed?
On Sunday, people across the United States held marches and rallies to denounce the recent rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the country. Protesters hit the streets in New York, San Francisco, Portland, and several other cities to show solidarity with the Asian American community. The demonstrations were held days after a gunman attacked three spas in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, killing eight people, six of whom were Asian women. The police are investigating whether the shooting spree was racially motivated, but the recent upsurge of verbal and physical attacks against the ethnic minority has raised serious concerns. The escalation of anti-Asian racism is attributed, for the most part, to the rhetoric adopted by former U.S. President Donald Trump after the novel coronavirus broke out in the country in March last year.
It's a disease, without question, has more names than any disease in history. I can name Kung Flu. I can name 19 different versions of names.
Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
But that's unlikely to be the only reason why the Asian community is increasingly coming under attack.
A lot of this anti-Asian violence and racism is has been simmering underneath the surface of the United States for centuries now. Trump is only a product or a symptom of what's been white nationalist and white supremacist legislation, policies, and ideologies that have existed within the U.S. for since its foundation.
Last year saw waves of anti-racism protests across the U.S. re-sparked following the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis police officer. With Trump no longer in the White House, many hoped things would turn for the better. But it seems like the former president has made a lasting impression that's proving hard to undo.
That report brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has sparked new controversy over when employees should return to their workplaces by suggesting people have had enough days off at home during the pandemic and should try to go back to their offices. The Prime Minister's comments, which followed remarks from the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, urging companies to reopen offices when the pandemic eases or risk losing staff, caused alarm among scientists and were branded by Labour as irresponsible and glaringly inconsistent with the government's own route out of lockdown. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer columnists Toby Helm and Philip Inman. The piece is titled "Boris Johnson Branded Irresponsible Over Back to the Office Call." Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has sparked new controversy over when employees should return to their workplaces by suggesting people have had enough days off at home during the pandemic and should try to go back to their offices. The Prime Minister's comments, which followed remarks from the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, urging companies to reopen offices when the pandemic eases or risk losing staff, caused alarm among scientists and were branded by Labour as irresponsible and glaringly inconsistent with the government's own route out of lockdown. They also came as some of the country's leading recruitment organizations told The Observer that revolutionary changes were inevitable in the world of work after the pandemic, with far more people wanting to work remotely and companies rethinking how to deploy staff most effectively. Experts also predicted a switch to hybrid working on a mass scale, meaning the old 5-day week model of office work being replaced with more flexible arrangements, such as 3 days at home and 2 days in the office. Monday, 29th of March, will see further easing of COVID-19 restrictions in England, with groups of up to 6 people or 2 families allowed to socialise outdoors and outdoor sports permitted. On Saturday, Wales became the first UK nation to lift the stay local requirement, as unlimited travel was permitted throughout the country. For Palm Sunday and Easter, small choirs will be allowed to perform at churches in England and be able to practice and perform inside places of worship if they are socially distanced. Congregations will be able to sing in church grounds. Boris Johnson and his ministers have not, however, changed official advice, which says that people should work from home if possible. The issue is the subject of a government review, and no changes are expected in the coming weeks, despite falls in COVID-19 hospital admissions and death rates over recent weeks. However, when asked at the Conservative Party's spring conference on Saturday, 27th of March, whether there should be a special bank holiday when the pandemic subsides, Boris Johnson said people should be thinking more about getting back to work than having more time off. The general view is people have had quite quite a few days off, and it wouldn't be a bad thing for people to see their way round to making a passing stab at getting back into the office, he said. Meanwhile, Labour's Andy MacDonald, the Shadow Employment Rights and Protection Secretary, said Boris Johnson's remarks could not be passed off as a joke and were deeply irresponsible. Andy MacDonald said he's trying to appease the libertarian wing of his party. On the one hand, by talking about getting back to the office, then suggesting he's being cautious. He just throws out comments like this. You can't ride two horses at once. It is not leadership. It is simply cavalier. MacDonald added that rather than promoting a return to office working as before, the government should be strengthening the right of employees to work from home when possible. A right to seek flexible and remote working should be matched by a duty on employers to grant such a request so far as it is reasonable, he said. The government has committed to launch a consultation on flexible working, which has yet to begin. Scientists warned that any immediate return to the office would be premature. At this point, the focus has to be on keeping new daily cases as low as possible, while the vaccination rollout continues, said Michael Head, senior research fellow in global health at Southampton University. Michael Head said, "We know that transmission is higher when people gather indoors for prolonged periods of time. Therefore, people should be encouraged to continue working from home for the foreseeable future." Professor Martin Hibbert from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine said the government should stick to a cautious approach and wait until later in the year before allowing anything like a return to normality. With infections stabilizing and new variants arriving, I feel we should be careful. If variant-adapted booster vaccines can arrive in September and be given on a background of low infection numbers, then I think we will finally be ahead of the virus, Professor Martin Hibbert said. Last July, when the first COVID-19 wave was easing, Boris Johnson also urged people to return to work if they were able to do so, well before official guidance was changed. His remarks at the time were seen by scientists as symptomatic of an overconfidence that allowed a second wave of the coronavirus to take hold in the autumn. With debate intensifying in corporate circles and trade unions over a return to office working, James Reid, chair of Reid, one of Britain's leading recruitment companies, said the effects of the pandemic on the way people worked would be profound and permanent. James Reid said, "We're seeing huge changes. There is no doubt from our conversations with employers and the types of jobs being advertised that the pandemic will lead to lasting changes in the way we live and work. While there are some people who believe there will be a rush back to the office across the board, I see no going back to the way we used to live and work. It is only a question of what is going to be the new normal." Different companies are adopting very different strategies. Last week, the Nationwide Building Society said it would allow all employees to work remotely, while the investment bank Goldman Sachs said it hoped to have all 34,000 employees based around the world back in the office as soon as possible. Neil Carberry, chief executive of the Recruitment and Employment Confederation, said he believed much more hybrid working was on the way. Neil Carberry said, "I think most five-day-a-week workers whose jobs are in a city like London, Manchester, Birmingham or Glasgow will not be doing 5 days a week in the office when this is all over," he said. The British government has said a further 58 people have died within 28 days of testing positive for the COVID-19 as of Saturday, bringing the UK total to 126,573.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو ذا الرحمن الله هو ذا المنان. لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear listeners, wherever you are, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Canning Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer the questions with regard to theology or whatever goes towards religion and the beliefs of people, specifically the followers of the School of Ahlul Bayt, in order to discuss these issues with scholars from seminary schools. We have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to this session. I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. Dear brothers and sisters, the question that we started talking about, and it was received by a questioner, that some of the Islamic rulings and laws actually look like barbarian laws, and they are very harsh, and it is not going to be implementing justice in the society. Rather, it is actually propagating and promoting a sort of savagery. This was the question that was asked, and actually the respected guest speaker of the show shed some light on the question. But I think before solving such issues, we need to know about the philosophy of such rulings and laws in Islamic context. It is good to learn Islam from pure from the right source. The right source in our understanding is Al-Quran itself and those who are the real and true interpreters of the Holy Quran, that is Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. So based on the School of Ahlul Bayt, we are trying to answer such questions in these series of shows, and specifically the question which was posed here concerning the harshness of the Islamic rulings and punishments is something that we shall discuss today, though it has been a little bit touched upon in our previous session, but we shall shed some more light on the philosophy of such laws in this session. Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools will help us to answer and clarify the point. Sheikhana, we're waiting for explanations.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We mentioned that, first of all, we are talking about the Islamic punishment for theft, which is, I mean, cutting off like four fingers, for example.
Yeah.
We said that, first of all, it's not including all the robbers and thieves. Rather, there are many conditions for them to be included in this punishment. Second of all, there are some ways to prove that. It's not only a matter of claim.
Mm-hmm.
Any crime should be proved for a Muslim jurist. Third of all, we said that although there is a discussion whether Muslims are able to implement the Islamic hudud at the time of the major occultation, and some Shia scholars believe that we are not allowed, but the majority of the contemporary Shia scholars believe that we need to implement the Islamic laws.
Mm-hmm.
But As we explained, they can be implemented only under an Islamic country.
Mm-hmm.
So Muslims have no right to act upon these laws if they live in non-Muslim countries.
Yeah.
But when it comes to this point, this punishment, we should think that Islam is not only this one verdict. Islam is a package of different laws which help the society reach social justice and oppose, poverty and train the people, and so on and so forth. So my point is that an ideal Islamic country is the one which trains all the subjects to know about Islamic laws and values, and then when it comes to economic issues, an Islamic country needs to help all the people to get rid of poverty.
Yeah.
So if Islam has such a punishment for a thief, the same Islam has many programs for the welfare of Muslim people living under an Islamic country.
Yeah.
So we need to take into account and into consideration all the Islamic laws related to this topic. The next point is that if we see that nowadays, unfortunately, the number of the people who are committing this sin are relatively more, maybe it is because of the fact that this Islamic law is not acted upon. As I mentioned in the previous program, we do not see so many examples of this Islamic law being implemented at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. We said that, first of all, one reason might be that although the punishment seems to be serious, but to prove that is very difficult. And second of all, it was because of the fact that Muslims refrained from committing that sin because the punishment was serious. So nowadays, some people claim that if you're going to cut the hands of the thieves, you need to cut the hands of, let's say, 10% people of a society. The answer is that this is not the case. I mean, if people come to know that, I mean, in practice, the punishment of cutting the hand will be implemented, then, even the majority of the thieves, they were looking for another job, an occupation. They are not going to continue to do this job. So if we have this sin committed by maybe many people, of course, relatively speaking, maybe it is because of the fact that this Islamic law is not acted upon. Now we have two issues. We have the maslaha, we have the expediency of a society, and the maslaha of one person. Imagine we have a city. In it we have 1 million people. They live in that city. If this punishment is implemented for one person, it prevents all other people who are going to commit the same crime.
Yeah.
And I think it really happens. I mean, if really people are sure and certain about the fact that the punishment for all these crimes will be implemented, then if not all, the majority of the criminals will abandon doing those crimes. So should we take into account and into consideration the welfare and maslaha and expediency of the minority of the criminals, or no, the maslaha of the society? I mean, in communities where many people, unfortunately, they are engaged in adultery or, rape, for example.
Yeah.
If you ask the majority of the people that if we implement a serious punishment for the criminals, in a short term, the number of the crimes will be decreased. The majority of the people, even in non-Muslim countries, they will tell you that we agree. Why not? So what he's done is to the maslaha of the minorities, of the criminals. My point is that when it comes to the Islamic hudud and Islamic punishments, if they are really implemented, then it is to the welfare of society and the most and the great majority of the people. But having said that, I need to explain another issue as well, and that is the fact that some people might ask that why nowadays in, for example, countries like Islamic Republic of Iran, some of these punishments are not implemented. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about, I mean, all the punishments, whether they are implemented or not, but we have another issue that should be taken into consideration as well, and that is one of the benefits of ijtihad as viewed by Shia school of thought, and also the concept of Wilayatul Faqih, the guardianship of the jurist. The point is that, according to the Shia scholars, sometimes if you act upon an Islamic law, you lose a more important maslaha or expediency.
Very true.
Let me give you an example, and I refer to a story which has happened at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We know
and
that.
Sheikh, before you continue, who is the person who's going to distinguish this expediency?
The jurist, the Shia jurist, the most
guardianship, learned. The guardianship,
yeah,
jurist.
But in our country, for sure, we are acting upon the rulings of Waliul Faqih, who, according to us, is the best person to decide about these issues. Because
okay. I know you mentioned, but sometimes in the low levels, when it goes to the executive levels, okay, when we have a judge in front of him, the person who is accused. So here, this is the judge who is going to issue the verdict, but the Wali al-Faqih is not available there. So does it mean that the Wali al-Faqih is going to make it countrywide ruling, or no, the judge himself decides to make it balanced?
I think in these cases, these issues, these verdicts are mentioned by Wali al-Faqih himself, and it will be implemented by all the judges in all over the Islamic,
territory.
All parts of the Islamic territory when we live in an Islamic country. So, for example, when it comes to the Raj or stoning to death, we know that it's not acted upon anymore in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it is based on an Islamic law.
Yeah.
So the, Islamic parliament, they passed this law, and it was confirmed by the Council of the Guardians. So it is nowadays, a law in the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have alternatives for that punishment. Let me give you that story,
yeah.
And then I will complete the point. We know that for many years after, for at least 25 years, we had the caliphate of three caliphs, Abu Bakr, Omar, and Uthman, and they brought a new innovation in Islamic community that was Salatul Taraweeh, which nowadays is also acted upon. And of course, the Sunnis, our Sunni brothers and sisters, they also agree that it was not practiced by Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family himself. So at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, it was expected from Imam Ali alayhi salam to remove this bid'ah and innovation. And it's been mentioned by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that when Imam Ali alayhi salam entered the city of Kufa, he told Imam Hassan alayhi salam that go to the mosque and tell the people that Salatul Taraweeh should not be at least said in jama'ah or congregation, because it's a kind of bid'ah or innovation. Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam went and announced that. People hearing that, they began to cry out that, this is the tradition of the second caliph. And so it began to be a kind of chaos among the people. Imam alayhi salam informed his father, Imam alayhi salam, and Imam said that, okay, in that case, let them continue this tradition. You see, a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam sees that there are two maslaha. The maslaha of preventing from a bid'ah like Salatul Taraweeh, and the maslaha of preventing a kind of chaos and division among the people.
Mm.
And he sees that the second one is much more important, so
yeah.
He allows the first one.
Definitely, the expediency of the Islamic Ummah is at the hand of the guardianship jurist, and also he knows best what is good for the Ummah, and it is beyond the Islamic rulings which are going to be practiced. And this is what we believe in the in sort of ijtihad, which is life and continuously actually shows its benefits and blessings to the Islamic Ummah. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, and your respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to us in QAnon Islamic Beliefs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى محن.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
According to the FBI's preliminary uniform crime report for the first half of 2020, murder and non-negligent manslaughter offenses increased 14.8%, and aggravated assault offenses were up 4.6% across the U.S. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ryan McMakin, editor. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Homicides Are Way Up in 2020. Here's more. According to the FBI's preliminary uniform crime report for the first half of 2020, murder and non-negligent manslaughter offenses increased 14.8%, and aggravated assault offenses were up 4.6% in the U.S. If the second half of 2020 proves to be about the same as the first half, then the nationwide homicide rate for 2020 will have risen from 5 per 100,000 in 2019 to 5.8 per 100,000 in 2020. That's a big increase and puts 2020's total at the highest rate recorded in 15 years, matching 2006 rate of 5.8 per 100,000. Some other data, however, suggests the year-end numbers for 2020 will be even worse than that. Homicides look to be up more than 20% during the fall of 2020 compared to the previous year. Thus, the increase from 2019 to 2020 may prove to be one of the largest increases in homicide in more than 50 years. Meanwhile, homicides in certain U.S. cities increased by far worse rates. Year-over-year increases of 30% or more were common in 2020, and this wasn't limited to only large cities. In data posted by researcher Jeff Asher, total year-over-year homicides through September 2020 were up in a wide range of locations, up 55% in Chicago, up 54% in Boston, up 38% in Denver, and up 105% in Omaha. It's much easier to count homicides than to determine the events and phenomena driving trends in homicides. It's never a good idea to attribute changes in homicide totals to any single cause. If you're looking to ask ourselves what might have caused such an unusually large rise in homicide across the U.S., we ought to look for unusual events. Most obvious among these, of course, are the stay-at-home orders, business closures, and lockdowns that have occurred since March of last year. These are pretty unusual things, although it is considered somewhat heretical to point out that lockdowns can produce negative societal side effects. The connection to violent behavior is so undeniable that this is now openly admitted. During the government-mandated lockdown, some organizations specifically devoted to violence prevention were shut down. And as noted by law professor Tracy Mears, the pandemic has prevented many anti-violence programs from operating. These programs, however, require a great deal of a face-to-face contact, typically among service providers and folks who are most likely to both commit these offenses and be the victims of them, Mears says. And it's a lot harder to do that when people can't meet in person. Of course, it's not that these people just can't meet in person as if it were physically impossible to do so. It's that in many places they are legally prohibited from doing so. This means even the most urgent cases were neglected and put on the back burner because policymakers made a decision to ignore the realities of violent crime in order to obsess over COVID risk. And this is a point must be made repeatedly. The pandemic isn't what caused the widespread destruction of social institutions that are key in increasing social cohesion and preventing violence. Government edicts did this. Certainly, given fears over COVID infection, it stands to reason that at least some people would have elected to stay home, and that important social institutions would have functioned at reduced capacity even without government mandates. However, what government mandates did was prevent people from even using their own discretion, which means even the most at-risk, isolated, and emotionally volatile people, the people who need these institutions the most, were cut off from important resources. Also important in understanding homicides is the fact that COVID lockdowns have increased domestic violence. Again, advocates for stay-at-home orders have used their bizarrely extreme preoccupation with COVID deaths as an excuse to insist it is worth it to keep women and children locked up with their abusers. Homicides have increased as a result in many cases. The lockdowns aren't the only factors behind rising crime, of course. Another factor is the rising homicide rate is likely the decline of public trust in police institutions. The reputations of police and police organizations appear to have gone into significant decline in recent years, as police encounters are increasingly being recorded and made public, thus exposing police abuse and what at least appears to be police abuse. These events have been connected to rising rates of violent crime. As noted by crime historian Ronaldo Froth, the public trust in government institutions, which certainly includes police, can impact a community's willingness to turn to violence in personal interactions. In other words, anti-police sentiment is regarded as a likely indirect cause of growing homicide rates. This declining trust manifested itself in last summer's riots, but the origins of the riots predate both the riots and the George Floyd case. But even when we look to the role of police agencies' status within the communities, we find that stay-at-home orders and lockdowns again play a role. It is the police, after all, who have been responsible for enforcing government orders to wear masks, close businesses, and avoid gatherings. Throughout 2020, U.S. police have been essential in harassing churchgoers, beating up nonviolent citizens for not social distancing, and arresting women for not wearing masks. Police have also arrested business owners and shut down their businesses. And then, there was the case of a 6-year-old girl who was taken from her mother because the mother wasn't wearing a mask when she dropped her daughter off at school. Who will be providing the regime's muscle when it comes to separating this child from her mother? Naturally, it will be the police. Although the police have continued to enjoy uncritical support from the Back the Blue movement, more reasonable people can only tolerate so much when it comes to police who willingly attack and arrest people from the non-crimes of using their own private property or not wearing a mask on a public sidewalk. It's unclear at this point if reversing policies that caused a year of community destruction can quickly undo the damage. The police must be out of the business of roughing people up in the name of social distancing. The politicians' obsession with isolating people must end.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.